Welcome to Imagine a World, a podcast created to ask the nation's thought leaders about senior health and mental health. I'm Rob Reback, CEO of Forefront Telecare and host of this podcast. Mental health, especially for seniors 65 plus, is a big part of today's healthcare business. One in four Americans have a mental or behavioral health condition. Behavioral health cases often go undetected, and the onset of chronic condition only exacerbates seniors' mental health. Is the system failing us? What could be changed or created to help individuals live longer, healthier, and happier lives, especially seniors? Many of these mental health conditions are treatable. Imagine a World will listen and try to figure out what some of the solutions might be. Forefront Telecare created Imagine a World podcast to listen to different ideas and opinions on living a longer, happier, healthier life for seniors. With that, let's get started and imagine. I'm here with my guest, Dr. Henry Harbin. Dr. Harbin is a psychiatrist with over 40 years of experience in the behavioral health field. He's held numerous leadership positions across the largest corporations in behavioral health, such as Greenspring Health Services and Magellan Health Services, and across the public sector at the state level in Maryland and the national level in the president's office. He's worked with many innovative early stage companies in mental health and also in the public sector, in the not-for-profit sector, the APA, NAMI, Mental Health America, and the Kennedy Forum, to name a few. In short, he's seen virtually every aspect of the mental health landscape over the last 40 years. Welcome, Dr. Henry Harbin. Welcome to Imagine a World podcast to talk about mental health and what we can do to improve mental health, especially for seniors. Henry, if you could, tell me a little bit about your background and the journey that you've taken in healthcare and what got you here to where you are today.
So thank you, Rob. I'm a psychiatrist. I've been in the field for, 40 plus years. I got interested in psychiatry in medical school and sort of sustained that interest and did my training in this area. And I got my interest in medicine. Actually on my father's side of the family, I'm a fourth generation physician. So it's sort of in the family tradition, wow. At least on my father's side of the family. I've been sort of in all areas of mental health and substance abuse. I've sort of spent a few years in academia, teaching and research, and I spent almost 10 years in the public health side of things. I was in the state mental health system in an administrative position in Maryland where I live. I did that for 10 years, and then I got involved with two different national managed mental health care companies where we were providing benefits and a network for people with mental health and substance abuse problems. And then really for the last number of years, I've been very interested in some of the newer technologies to provide a treatment for people with mental health and substance use problems, whether digital or teletherapy ones or devices, or new types of treatment, but different settings. So I've been involved for a long time, and my experience of being in all aspects, both as a provider, a teacher, a public health official, and a managed care administrator, I've really tried to, over the last decade, be involved in policy and advocacy to make practice changes for the delivery of mental health and substance abuse nationally.
Fantastic, Henry. Well, I appreciate that. And it's a really impressive background. Obviously, you've looked at all aspects of these issues. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the biggest issues you see in mental health today and how that has evolved over the last four decades.
Probably the biggest challenges, I think, are people getting access to effective mental health or substance abuse care. That's one major problem. Another major problem is the slowness in identifying new treatments for mental health and substance abuse problems. There's a research gap. There's been a lot of research on the brain in the last 40 years, but only a few new and novel drugs or psychiatric or psychosocial interventions. But what I have spent most of my time over the last several decades and more recently on a policy advocacy side is trying to make available to people with mental health or substance abuse problems the treatments we know they do work. Some of our treatments are quite old. Some are effective for some people and not others. But we know we have a gap of getting better treatment, even for those conditions we know that we could have a big impact on. Part of the issue is that the primary locus of where most mental health and substance abuse cares is in primary care. And that would include pediatricians' offices, obstetrics and gynecology, internal medicine, family practice. So there are about 100 psychiatric medications that are available today. And most of the majority of those are prescribed by primary care physicians and clinicians. Unfortunately, oftentimes because of the lack of resources, the effectiveness of that care in primary care is quite poor. So patients might get started on an antidepressant and they may not be followed up on. The medication might be changed. They may not get psychotherapy added to that. So one of the major focuses that I and others are working on is to improve the delivery of mental health, both screening and treatment in primary care. Given that we have a model called collaborative care where behavioral health resources are embedded and added to the primary care team. That's a well-proven intervention, over 80 randomized trials, lots of implementation. So we know that people with mild to moderate mental health and substance abuse problems in particular, you can see 2%, 3%, and 400% improvement in outcomes in those primary care practices that are doing what's called collaborative care. So that's a major focus. Most primary care practices don't have any additional behavioral health expertise help, and this model, it allows them to bill for these services and provide them. So one of the problems is for a lot of people that could get effective help with psychotherapy or telemental health or maybe a low dose of a psychiatric drug are not getting access to that. They're not being identified earlier. One of the problems in the field of mental health is that on average, it takes about 10 years from the time that a person has symptoms of a mental health problem or a substance abuse problem before they are diagnosed and treated. So that's almost a decade-long lag in intervening. So you can imagine in the world of COVID that we've been dealing with for the last almost 2 years now, that if the public health officials and leaders in a country were to tell the population, well, it's going to be about 10 years from the time you get a fever and symptoms of infection with COVID before we diagnose you and treat you, I think you'd probably have a revolt in any country in the world right now. But that's the norm for people with mental health and substance abuse problems.
Indeed. And Henry, COVID has obviously exacerbated mental health problems. Do you think that perhaps COVID has so heightened the awareness of mental health problems that 10 years may shrink in part due to COVID?
Yes, I do. That's a good point. It's made things definitely worse. But one of the silver linings in the COVID is that the whole healthcare system has turned to telehealth, both on the medical and the mental health side, where people are now providing phone-based or video-based therapies. This was necessary in particular when the many healthcare systems were shut down. Our patients weren't allowed to go to care unless it was an emergency. So this has added a newer way or a more efficient way to offer more access to effective mental health and substance abuse care. It does, though, also heighten people's awareness. Unfortunately, we've had a 10-year pandemic in mental health and substance abuse in terms of death rates. So if you look at the ultimate outcomes for mental health and substance abuse, which is how many people die a year, it's over, you know, close to 150 people a year die of either a substance abuse-related problem or a mental health problem, suicide. This has been a 10-year escalation without much impact. And yet we see what can happen on the medical side with cancer and heart disease, where we see significant improvement in death rates over the last decade, but mental health and substance abuse have gone negative. So in a way, COVID has escalated an already deteriorating situation. But I think it has brought a lot more attention at the governmental level, at the private sector level, about what we need to do differently or more of that would make a big difference in access to quality care.
So Henry, I think improved screening is likely to help. Telehealth is likely to help. But in terms of access, how are we going to solve the provider problem We've seen, especially on the psychiatrist side, we've seen a big drop in the number of psychiatrists in the country, just as over the last 5 to 10 years, exacerbated by the pandemic, as you point out, the demand for mental health services is going through the roof. How are we going to solve the provider problem is question number one. And how are we going to solve improving the speed with which new treatments actually come through the pipeline? Are those solvable problems in your mind?
Yes, I do think they are. I think it's multimodal interventions. The workforce problem, yes, there are probably not enough psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, or psychologists, social workers, but there are a fair number. Unfortunately, a lot of them are not in the insurance networks. They don't join Medicaid, they don't join Medicare, they don't join the commercially insured population. Now, part of that is related to a lack of parity in reimbursement and access. And part of it is just that there's been an overwhelming need and recognition of people need mental health services, and it's overwhelmed the available therapists that are in network. But if you look at in and out of network, there are a lot of people getting care. It's just at a much more expensive rate for those who have to go out of network. There's a group of employer and purchasers that I work with called the Path Forward for Mental Health and Substance Use, and working with leading behavioral health provider organizations like the American Psychiatric Association and others. We have a multi-pronged solution for the workforce issue. So one is this collaborative care, it's integrating in primary care that I mentioned, which is if you add a psychiatrist consultant and a behavioral health therapist to the primary care team, you improve outcomes, as I mentioned earlier, but you also reduce the need to go be referred to a specialist in their office. So a psychiatrist that's a consultant to the primary care team rather than the primary clinician can handle 3 or 4 times the number of patients than if he or she were seeing them all in their office. So this is a way to extend this limited expertise on a broader basis. This is true for the care of diabetes or heart disease. We are never going to have enough cardiologists or endocrinologists to treat all diabetics. So primary care practices do a lot of that work, and then they refer when needed.
You mentioned cardiovascular and diabetes. It's been tried for a longer number of years, so maybe that's the answer. But it has been tried in behavioral health more recently with very mixed effectiveness. What makes this so hard to execute on specifically in psychiatry?
You mean in terms of the improvement in primary care?
Yes, the primary care collaboration and the consult specifically for psychiatry. Why is it hard to execute on this where it appears to have worked in cardiovascular and other specialty areas over the years?
Well, we have, actually, Rob, we have 80 clinical trials showing it's effective. And then we have existing clinical demonstration models now going on 2 decades in large systems. So we have good evidence. The resistance actually seems to be, Rob, on the provider side. So a lot of medical systems that, have big primary care practices have been slow to uptake this. So a lot of the work of the Path Forward and others is to try to provide some training and technical assistance to practices so they can adopt this. But it's really just helping primary care practices do, as you point out, what they do for diabetes and heart disease, meaning they track the care with a clinical lab test, they bring them back on a regular basis and monitor and change their treatment based on their scores. And then when necessary, they refer them to a specialist for more intensive interventions, and then they may come back to the primary care practice of diabetes. So it's interesting that the slowness of this at this point, many of the payers, most of the commercial carriers, Medicare are paying for the code, about 18 Medicaid states, but many of the medical systems are slow to do this. So we think there's an education, an advocacy, a purchaser push on this, and many mechanisms to try to get more uptake.
Please don't misinterpret my question. I'm a big fan, and I see the evidence as well. My question was more around what's going to help it scale up, so I appreciate the answer. Can you tell me about the other 3 legs of the stool for a path forward?
So telebehavioral health is another. We announced the sort of the beginning of the path forward right a few months before COVID's hit. One of our recommendations was expansion of telemental health and telesubstance abuse. So that has really happened a lot. And now the focus of the employer community and the purchasers that are part of the path forward is to make sure that these flexible arrangements during the COVID will continue. So, for instance, that you pay for audio or video telemental health care. So we think that telebehavioral care will, one, address and access more people with these problems earlier on. Some psychiatrists and psychologists are willing to do telebehavioral and be in network for that, so to speak, where they may not want to do that for their office-based care. So we think between collaborative care and primary care and telebehavioral care that you reduce the need for in-office specialty care, which is a, you know, a scarce resource. I think the other is we view the whole digital focus on digital mental health and substance abuse tools. There's pretty good evidence that, for instance, cognitive behavioral therapy delivered by a computer, okay, digitally on an app, it can be as effective as face-to-face cognitive behavioral therapy. So obviously, this is a lot easier for a consumer to access these. And there's a plethora, thousands and thousands of behavioral apps now trying to make it easy, engaging, to gamify the interface and interactions. And I believe these, there's evidence for this, that this is going to do two things. It will bring more people into treatment that would never go to see a psychiatrist or psychologist, not going to bring it up in primary care, who can now get some help from a digital app. And there are increasingly number of digital interventions that are not just adjunctive, but are offering treatment.
Fantastic. Henry, could we go back to a path forward and tell us about the remaining leg or two of your stools?
So one is just a push on access to in-network mental health care. So there is a push on the parity law or full enforcement of the parity law by these employers who are regulated on parity. There are a number of things that health plans and employers could do. One is to increase reimbursement. There was a big study that I was involved with on Milliman over a five-year period that showed on average, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers are paid 20 to 80% less in some areas than primary care doctors or other medical specialists on the two most common office-based billing codes. So they might pay a primary care doctor, you know, $120 for an office visit, and a psychiatrist for the same code, $100. This documented a big disparity in reimbursement rates. And so one of the things that the employer coalition, and of course, many of the parity regulators are pushing that if you're willing to raise rates for a cardiologist or an internist to have them be in your networks in an adequate way, you need to be doing the same thing for mental health therapists and professionals. There are other things that some commercial insurers are, for instance, they close their networks and don't take any more mental health or substance abuse provider types, which given the shortage is kind of, you know, self-defeating. The third category is that some of the health plans do not fast-track credentialing and adding mental health and substance abuse professionals. So there are a number of practical administrative things. Some of them are not costly. Some of them might cost a little more that health plans or self-insured employers could do to increase the number of mental health professionals. The other thing that this same Milliman study showed, in addition to reimbursement disparities, they also found significant out-of-network disparities.
Henry, let's shift over to seniors, some of the biggest mental health issues facing seniors today. What do you see as some of the biggest issues facing seniors specifically?
Of course, seniors have, you know, some unique problems. Many times, even if they don't have dementia, they have mild to moderate cognitive impairments that are often go unrecognized and unaddressed. There's a lot of loneliness, particularly if they're widowed or divorced or living alone. You see more of those problems, particularly for people that retire or their spouse dies. They're really at high risk for suicide in that age group. And that group in particular are more likely to rely on their primary care doctor for mental health care. In fact, some of the early studies, Rob, that were done with this collaborative care model were done with Medicare and with seniors. And we also know with seniors, their reaction to medications, both psychiatric and medical, is they're quite sensitive dose-wise to some of these medicines. So it's really important that you get the psychopharmacological interventions right, whether you're a primary care doctor or a psychiatrist. So I think that seniors carry some unique challenges, which some of these same interventions could make a big difference. So I think some of these tools, these digital assessments, could be really helpful to the elderly. And there are a number of cognitive training things that are out there for improving your memory, focus, attention, with some pretty good efficacy from some of these interventions. But of course, telebehavioral health care, it becomes a really important tool, whether it's kind of case management or actual having a therapist or a psychiatrist providing the phone or video-based teletherapy, becomes another way to outreach to this group, particularly as, you know, they just may not want to go to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist in their office. They need more than an occasional primary care visit, and you could handle the meds that way, the medication. So I think seniors can benefit from these interventions that we were talking about earlier about how do you improve access to effective care. They could benefit a lot from this.
I guess, as you say, especially for maybe the younger seniors and or those that either aren't as high acuity and maybe have a little bit more tech savvy. What about the older seniors, those that are sort of, you know, well into their 80s and 90s and right, are sicker and maybe less tech savvy? How do you help them?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I don't want to leave out, because this is so important for the aging, you know, population, is that physical fitness and physical exercise is the best one thing you could do for just about any medical or mental health problem. So keeping up with physical fitness is really important for your brain health. Whether you're 80, 90, or I've met probably over the last decade at least five CEOs who are 85 or older, CEOs of their companies, and still running them after age 85. So people do stay, if they can stay mentally healthy particularly, it's a big thing. But I think there, the some of the case management outreach that could be done by phone or as an extension of the primary care office, in this collaborative care model, it pays for behavioral health care managers who can, most of their job is really virtual, meaning they can be calling people, reminding them about the appointment. The only priority I didn't talk about on the path forward side that is key to this is what we're calling measurement-based care, which is the use of mental health assessment tests, like a lab test, that measures how well you're doing and your functionings, how depressed are you, how anxious are you, and there are cognitive tools to measure, you know, what's your working memory, are you forgetting things. So this measurement-based care is, unfortunately, in the mental health world, very few specialists, psychiatrists, psychologists, use a standardized quantifiable clinical rating scale to monitor progress and help guide treatment. And unfortunately, primary care doctors who always, almost always, use a lab test to treat every medical problem. You can imagine if you had a doctor and you had diabetes or hypertension, they never measured your blood sugar with a lab test or they never measured your blood pressure, you would fire them or sue them if they didn't do that. But in mental health, that's done rarely, including by primary care doctors who do it routinely for other non-mental health problems. And this is really important for the elderly as well as other age groups that when they go see a doctor, let's say primary care or a therapist, if they're using an assessment tool that's quantified and standardized, it would, one, pick up earlier whether or not they need additional mental health help or any mental health help. And it also allows you to be more effective in your treatment. So this is a major improvement in outcomes.
Two last questions. I want to first talk very local and then talk global. Locally, I want to ask you about the challenges for our rural counties specifically and what can be done to address some of the challenges that seniors and others face in rural America, where the access and some of the other issues are even more pronounced. Do you have any thoughts on success in the rural communities?
Yes. Well, it is a challenge for all medical care and mental health care. About 50% of the counties in the U.S. have no mental health or substance abuse professionals at all, period, zero. So a model that requires in-office-based specialty mental health care is going to be limited or impossible in many rural areas. That's where this collaborative care model, which has been tested in rural small primary care practices as well as large urban practices, is key, because the behavioral health people are virtual in that model. They don't have to be virtual, but in the rural models, there are several outcome studies done in rural settings and now clinical implementations being done all the time, where the care behavioral health care manager and the consulting psychiatrist are virtual. That's also where the telebehavioral health care, in addition to collaborative care, come into place, particularly for psychiatrists who can back up the primary care doc to be prescribing psychiatric medications in a rural setting. So the shortage that we're having of, you know, a workforce of specialty care is, of course, completely exacerbated in a rural setting. So we have a proven model that could be addressed between the two of the things of the path forward, telebehavioral and psychiatric collaborative care.
And now on a global basis, are there countries out there that you look to that are doing a better job that we're doing in the U.S. and that we can learn from here in the U.S.?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I don't think there's any one country that I could point to where they are doing a great job. Even some of the single-payer kind of government-sponsored programs, some of the more developing countries, you know, they have very few specialists. They don't even have the problem of accessing those specialists. They just don't have very many. And that situation, some of them are doing things like collaborative care, integrated care. I think that's almost the only choice some of these countries have if they want to improve access to mental health care. So I don't know any country that I would say has done it all or done all the things you really could do that would make a huge difference. All the countries, of course, suffer from the lack of new technologies and the scientific, I would say, gaps.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, Henry, any other closing thoughts you'd like to add before we wrap?
No, I think you've covered a lot of ground, and I guess there are two themes that I find myself working on, trying to work with different groups to accomplish it is, if you could put them in a broader context, we know that the healthcare system that we have in the U.S. can produce significant improvements in outcomes for very major medical problems. And one of the things is we need to make that healthcare system work for behavioral health, and it's not currently for the most part. So that and the fact that we do have effective interventions for many of these problems, not all, and it's kind of shame on us that we can't make those things available for the people that it would have big impacts on outcomes.
I would agree. Well, Dr. Henry Harbin, thank you for joining us on Imagine a World podcast. Fascinating discussion, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me.